You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 4th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
And a very happy Across the Universe Day to everyone today.
Across the Universe Day.
Is it National Beatles Day?
Not quite.
It's a good guess.
So on this day last year, NASA transmitted Across the Universe, the Beatles song, as you alluded to, Rebecca, in the direction of the star Polaris, which is 431 light years from Earth.
Huh.
Cool.
I would have gone with the Rolling Stones.
It was done to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the song's recording and the 45th anniversary of the Deep Space Network. And, of course, the 50th anniversary of NASA, which was last year. So it marked several occasions all in one. Across the Universe.
That's a very cool way to celebrate it.
I think so. And the people in Polaris will appreciate it 430 years from now.
So, Bob, you're going to tell us about some interesting news from Google and NASA called the Singularity University. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that got my attention. NASA and Google Inc. are teaming up with scientists, and especially futurist Ray Kurzweil, to create something called the Singularity University. This official announcement was made recently at the annual TED, or Technology, Entertainment, and Design Conference in Long Beach, California. Now, the term singularity in this context does not refer to a black hole, but the increasingly popular idea that technological change feeds on itself, accelerating beyond what intuition might tell us. This could create game-changing technologies and industries, not in many generations, but maybe in less than one generation. And it is this idea advocated by Ray Kurzweil in his book, The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. That book is what gave Dr. Peter Diamandis the idea for this university. He is the founder and chairman of the XPRIZE Foundation and also co-founded the International Space University. So what's this university going to do, and why do I want to go there so bad? If you go to their website, singularity-university.org, their mission statement says that the Singularity University aims to assemble, educate, and inspire a cadre of leaders who will strive to understand and facilitate the development of exponentially advancing technologies and apply, focus, and guide these tools to address humanity's grand challenges. Executive Director Salim Ismail describes it this way. He says, what we're trying to do is create a group of young leaders that can understand the implications of the rapid acceleration that's happening in a lot of technologies today and manage that technology. It's not going to be cheap. It's $25,000 for one of their summer 9-week courses.
Why so expensive? I mean, did they justify that?
It's quite a unique experiment. I'm not sure why it's quite that much.
Is it the prestige, or is there really some high-tech stuff going on?
Well, yeah, it is. Well, by definition, it's about as high-tech as it gets. The first, it's split into three-week sessions. The first one, the students will be diving into things like biotechnology, computing, artificial intelligence, energy, even law and finance. Then for the next 3 weeks, I think the students will pick one of those for a really deep exploration, one of those key fields that they'll take. So maybe if you already are an artificial intelligence guy, maybe you'll want to look deep into, say, biotechnology or energy or something else. And then the last 3 weeks, now that's the special part of it. This is where the students work on a special project. And this is the part that was strongly advocated by Google co-founder Larry Page. And in this, for this special project, the students take a cross-disciplinary approach and apply what they've learned to things like energy shortages, famine and global warming, climate change, poverty. One person described this saying that, imagine looking at hunger from an AI and robotics standpoint. So the idea is to foster this cross-disciplinary approach and network with other people in other fields throughout the world. And it's not just grads and postgrads that can go to this thing. They're also going to offer 10-day and 3-day seminars that are held throughout the year for top executives and things like that. I'm excited about this. I see these technologies coming down the pike that people aren't even aware of.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I mean, the press release says they're going to focus on nanotechnology, biotechnology, and artificial intelligence. And those are the three technologies that Kurzweil argues in his book, The Singularity is Near, that are going to really cause the singularity, because those are the ones that will essentially make all technologies information-based. And when technologies are information-based, he argues, that's when we see this exponential increase in advancement.
Yeah, those and other ones. It's not just going to be them, but they're definitely going to be a huge part of it.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about information is that information and ideas, it's not a zero-sum game. It's a win-win. And this kind of cross-fertilization, it leads to unforeseeable consequences, you know, meaning unforeseeable benefits. The kind of new ideas that get spun out of these kind of think tanks have tremendous potential. It's also interesting that Kurzweil remains such a controversial figure. He is kind of like the Nikola Tesla of our age in that he's undeniably brilliant in some ways and has achieved some real...
Well, inventions. The guy's an amazing inventor. I mean, some of the things he's come out with. He was the first to come out with a book that you put the book on this reader, optical reader, and it turns the pages and reads the books. I think Stevie Wonder was like the first one years ago to buy this device, and now this device is like you could like almost fit it in your pocket. It's so tiny. Was just one of the predictions he's made that's come true. And yeah, it is controversial, and I think he's primarily controversial because the whole accelerating changes idea and how fast he thinks it's going to come upon us.
He is at the optimistic end of the spectrum in terms of projecting forward. But that's not the most controversial thing about him, in my opinion. I think it's the fact that he takes something like 230 different supplements that he believes is going to make him live a lot longer, long enough so that, you know, live long enough to become immortal, right? That's his goal. Uh-huh. And you know, that's, you know, it's interesting because that's pure pseudoscience. You know, take those. There's no evidence behind those supplements. He's probably doing himself more harm than good by taking so much crap. And he also sells it. It's not like it's just doing it personally. He's teamed up with someone else to actually be selling this sort of supplement regimen. That's extremely dubious. So you have this combination of a brilliant inventor, really provocative thinker, and yet a total charlatan sort of wrapped up into one figure. Again, that's why I think it has a sort of same feel to me as Nikola Tesla.
Yeah, I have not looked into that whole aspect of it, and you're right. It is very disconcerting, and maybe I purposely haven't looked into it because it's a very disappointing aspect of what... But I don't think it necessarily detract...
Well, yeah, I mean, that's why we value the ideas and not the person. I mean, people are fallible, and we see it again and again and again, you know? Oftentimes people will ask us, like, well, what do you think of Bill Maher? Don't you think he's a terrible skeptic? And it's like, well, that's not really the point. The point is, sure, he says some crazy things, he says some rational things, and the idea is to just keep focusing on the rational and promoting that while correcting the irrational.
Yeah, it's like Linus Pauling, brilliant scientist, spent the end of his life promoting utter quackery. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you reconcile those two things? Well, people are people. They were flawed.
Yeah, we've talked about people like this on the show before, and you know, I would look at Ray Kurzweil as a visionary, and I think people that have that kind of personality, it's not unlikely for them to also have, you know, they're thinking radically about a lot of different things.
Yeah, you're thinking outside the box, you know, not to overuse that cliche, but it's true. You know, you're thinking in a very highly speculative, provocative way, and you're going to be wrong a lot. You're going to take a lot of chances. You're going to be wrong a lot. And that's okay. If you're right occasionally, that's probably more valuable than being wrong a lot because we can get past the errors. So it's good to have people stirring up the pot like that, like Kurzweil.
You know, but keep in mind, too, he's taking a lot of supplements, right? That's what Steve said.
Yeah.
You know, that is not the craziest thing I've ever heard, you know?
No, it's just the contrast with the fact that he's actually has a lot of legitimate ideas as well.
Yeah, but we're not saying that he's like thinking about things that are, even though that taking a lot of vitamins, like you said, you know, there's a lot of controversy about that as well. You know, it's not like an insane thing that he's doing. It's just, you know, to me, it's more wishful thinking.
Well, no, it's a potentially harmful thing, though, especially since, you know, he lends his name to give them credibility. I mean, it's a terrible thing.
The bottom line is, it's all a bit kooky.
And I got to tell you one more thing. This yet again is another example of me not, like, I don't want to know that much about him. Like, I've read his books. I'm fascinated by this guy's mind. And I don't want to spoil, you know, it's like
you know, it doesn't spoil it to me, because I'm interested in human nature and human psychology. And to me, it's fascinating that he would combine these attributes. And I want to know why. What is it about him that makes him both a kook when it comes to these supplements and a really provocative thinker when it comes to artificial intelligence and futurist technology? That's what interests me. I don't want to hide from that at all. I think we have something that we could learn about the nature of people, of science, of ourselves, of skepticism by thinking about people like Ray Kurzweil, people who are not typical, you know, the typical true believer, you know, who's gullible just about everything, and the typical skeptic who's largely skeptical about most things. Yeah, we've sort of got characters down pretty well, but then you have somebody who breaks the mold like Kurzweil, and it's fascinating.
Yeah, I guess you're right. This is actually very different than, say, Christian Bale, like, totally losing his stuff on the set.
No.
Because you expect that of him.
You're right, Steve. It's more of like a analyzing his character and seeing like where his mind takes him.
Well, I think we should ask him when we finally get him on this damn show. So let's.
We do need to get him on the show. Well, we'll make that our project.
Get on that, will you?
Let's go on to the next news item. This is a follow-up story. We have spoken a few times in the past about the archaeology of the New World, of the Americas. And if you remember, the Clovis people, who were the remains of the first human settlements in the Americas.
Yep.
And they disappeared around 13,000 years ago, around the same time that a lot of the megafauna of the New World also disappeared. I think the last news item we discussed about this was evidence for a large comet explosion over Canada. And the thinking at the time was that this may have been responsible for the extinction of a lot of the megafauna of the New World, as well as perhaps even the Clovis people. Well, now there's some follow-up on that. This is a genuine controversy within the archaeological community, and they're fighting it out, as they should be, with the evidence. And now there was a new survey done of past fires. When there's a large forest fire, that leaves behind a telltale sign in the geological record. For example, there are bogs where the layers are preserved through time, so you could go back, and it's actually like a record of whenever fires occurred in the past, and they could be dated pretty well. So an extensive survey has just been published looking at this. If it is true, if it were true that a large comet exploding over Canada wiped out the mammoths, for example, just as a representative species of megafauna at the time, then we would have expected there to be wildfires throughout the Americas at around the same time. That's a prediction of the comet theory of mammoth extinction, if you will. Well, this paper did not show that. It showed that there were scattered fires, but at different times in different places, but not this one continent-wide fire that you would expect to see from a comet big and devastating enough to have created so many extinctions. So now this is sort of pushing back from the other side, you know, the other school of thought, which does not believe in the comet theory, and they're saying that, you know, the lines of evidence that the comet promoters have been putting forward are going to fall one by one, and this is just the first one to go. So I always find it fascinating to watch these genuine scientific controversies play out, you know, trading punches with the evidence, and it looks like this one is definitely a notch against the comet theory, but something that is certainly not settled, and we'll have to wait for further evidence before I think a consensus emerges.
Wouldn't there have been worldwide fires, not just isolated to the Americas?
I don't think so. I mean, it wasn't a worldwide extinction. It really was continent-wide. So I think they're just looking for continent-wide effects.
Yeah, the 1908 comet or impact in Siberia.
Yeah,
was more. I don't think that had a worldwide impact.
Something between Tunguska and the whatever wiped out the dinosaurs. You know. So still a very interesting mystery, and there's some specific pieces of evidence that we are looking for that we haven't found yet. You know, for example, we have sites with with technological remains, with stone tools, but no human feces or anything with DNA in it that we can type. And we have other sites that have DNA but no tools. So we're still waiting for that one site that has a Clovis tool and something that we can get DNA from. And so that's we're waiting for the day where that gets announced, where that finding is made, because that will end a lot of the debate about what happened to the Clovis people. Did they completely go extinct, or did they merge with a later immigration of people that then became the modern American Indians? So very interesting. Another really interesting news item just from a couple of days ago, and this one's on the exoplanet front. We have found yet again...
It's the littlest exoplanet.
That's right. Yet again, the smallest and the cutest exoplanet.
I think
it seems every week there's a new coolest exoplanet, but
my prediction of 100 new exoplanets this year is probably on pace.
Do you know how many we've discovered so far?
Three.
Let's see. It's the first week of February. 8.
40.
No, I don't know for sure.
Do you know how many total exoplanets?
Oh, that we've ever discovered?
Yeah,
it's over 300.
It's got to be in the
Seven.
Yes, it's in the hundreds. 300 about.
400.
339.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was
the first one was discovered in 1995, 51 Pegasi B, which is about 50 light years away.
A lovely place.
Yep. This new one is about 450 light years away, and it is only twice as large as the Earth. The previous record holder for the smallest exoplanet was about five times the size of the Earth. This one is only twice.
Nice.
That means that it is probably a rocky world, not a gaseous world like mm-hmm. Jupiter, just because of its size. It'd be really difficult. There's also another reason why it's probably not gaseous, because it's very, very close to its sun. Do you guys know how long it takes for this planet to go around its star?
20 hours.
Yeah, not 20
wow.
years, not 20 days, 20 hours.
Wow. That thing must be whipping
Steve,
around
how big,
fast.
How big is that? The mass of that sun compared to our own?
It's a little smaller and cooler than our sun. But 20 hours, that thing is like whipping around the atmosphere of that star.
So if we lived on that planet, we could live for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
Imagine the gravity on that planet sucking you down.
Well, the tidal forces would be amazing.
Probably. Oh, forget about it.
Yeah. So the surface temperature is estimated at between 1,000 and 1,500 degrees.
Yeah, it's hot.
So,
yeah.
You know, that's
a little toasty.
Could be molten. Yeah.
But it's a dry heat.
But it's a dry heat, yeah. It's not
sorry,
a candidate for life, but it's showing that the techniques we're using now and the telescopes that we're using are capable of finding such a tiny little planet, only twice the size of Earth. Phil Plait thinks we're within a year or two of finding a truly Earth-sized planet.
That's great.
Wow.
That's crazy.
And then
yeah.
there'll be smaller ones even to find beyond that.
Right. But of course, you know, just for psychological reasons, we want to find an Earth-sized planet that's about the Earth's distance from its star, so that it would be at a distance where water would be in a liquid form.
With a nitrogen-oxygen atmosphere.
Yeah, well.
And populated with hot dudes.
Oxygen in the atmosphere would mean that there is almost certainly life.
Woohoo.
Cool.
Very cool. Exoplanets are cool.
Yes, sir.
Evan, you are going to give us an updated report on the Japanese craze over blood type.
Well, there was a report in the Associated Press this week, which states, in the year just ended, 2008, four of Japan's top 10 best-selling books were about how blood type determines personality. Yes, you heard it right.
They were named A, B, A, B, and O. It was a series of books, one book for each blood type.
And they sold over 5 million copies.
Combined.
Of each?
Right. Combined in 2000.
Combined,
2008.
Right.
Wow.
So,
that's
you
still
can,
pretty
if you
good.
Can believe that. Now, what this amounts to, frankly, is nothing more than you get out of astrology, really.
It's astrology. It is
but bloodier. It's like zombie
it
astrology.
It sure is. But it's very ingrained in the culture. Very ingrained in the culture. For example, the prime minister, he considered it important enough to reveal his blood type profile on the web. He's an A, and his rival, opposition leader, is a B. And he was, you know, comparing the traits, I guess, between, well, what they claim, the traits of people who have A blood type versus B blood type are.
Oh my God, it's just so absurd.
And, you know, it's crazy. It's
annoying.
It's a wild concept. Yeah, you know, and this actually, what's even I felt more annoying is looking into this a little bit is the history of it, is that you know, this was first the idea of typing people based on blood types was really used in Nazi Germany to further their ideas of supremacy over different races. And during the 1920s and the 1930s, this was also adopted by some people in Japan. And there was a paper in 1927 that was published in Japan called The Study of Temperament Through Blood Type by Taijeki Furukawa. It took off. It just became a fad, really, is what it was. And but the government took it seriously, and they did some studies, some pretty bad studies, in regards to breeding programs and how to, you know, maximize the potential for you know, breeding people with more desirable blood types than others. And you know, total bunk, total nonsense. And although it went away soon afterwards, it was revised again. Or revived again, I should say, in the 1970s. A fellow by the name of Masahiko Nomi, who was a lawyer, basically, decided to write books on the blood types and just bring it back into the culture. And thanks to him, ever since in the 1970s, this craze has seeped into the Japanese culture, and millions of people in Japan take it true to heart. They really, really believe that personalities are determined by blood type.
Yeah, it's easy. It's no different than just the commonality of astrology in Western culture.
Well, it seems like they take it a bit more seriously because, you know, you wouldn't have Barack Obama accusing Hillary Clinton of being a Virgo or something, and that's why she shouldn't lead, you know. It seems like it's much more serious if they're actually pulling it into politics and legitimizing it that way.
That's right. And it also is striking, you know, to us, of course, it seems ridiculous. You know, what proteins in the blood are somehow going to affect your personality? I mean, that seems absurd. And yet, how many people believe that the position of the planets around the time of your birth has some magical effect on your personality?
You know, there are people that believe that you should eat a particular diet depending on your blood type.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, well,
we talked about that.
That's what we did talk about before, was the sort of blood type diets and things like that. That's utter nonsense. But this is more of sort of the astrological angle to it.
It's things like that that make me think that this isn't driven so much by a desire to discriminate against others, but more along the lines of it's like this individual need people have to learn more about themselves somehow, and it kind of fulfills that need.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I think we're ultimately egocentric, and people like to hear things about themselves. And then confirmation bias kicks in.
Yeah.
You know, you think, oh, yeah, that does sound like me. You know, I am sometimes outgoing and at other times not so outgoing. Yeah, that's
And there have been a few studies that have shown that when people are raised, or I shouldn't say that have shown, that have suggested that people who are raised to understand what traits are associated with their, say, sun sign or their blood type or whatever, they actually do end up taking on those traits. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, a couple other ways for the folks in Japan that they take this very seriously is that matchmaking agencies provide blood type compatibility tests. Companies make decisions about assignments based on an employee's blood type.
Right.
Children in kindergarten are divided up by blood type.
Wow. Can you imagine?
And the women's – talk about confirmation bias and women. The women's softball team that won gold at the Beijing Olympics used the theory to customize each player's training. Mm-hmm. So, of course, it had to have worked. Otherwise, they wouldn't have won the gold. So, therefore, the blood typing and the routine in the regiment must have worked.
We have a lot of expats listening to the show, and I'm wondering if anybody – living in Japan can report back to us and let us know whether or not that's all true. Because I always wonder when news reports come out of especially non-English speaking countries, whether or not things are a bit exaggerated or anything.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, it's hard to get – you never really get a good insider's view of what's really going on from some, you know, mainstream press just reporting about it, because there is a lot of opportunity to distort what the real picture is.
We should note, though, that this writer for the Associated Press, their name is Mari Yamaguchi. I would assume by the name that this is a Japanese person in Tokyo that is doing the report. So
yeah.
That should be noted.
But could you imagine, though, okay, going under the idea that what Evan said was accurate, could you imagine somebody sitting there and by just somebody's blood type coming up with an exercise program for an athlete? Like, I wonder what parameters they're altering to suit the athlete.
But that's like using handwriting analysis, which is very common in corporate culture in the United States. Mm-hmm. A lot of companies will do handwriting analysis on employee applications.
Yeah, and of course there are personality tests, that most of which are just rife with pseudoscience. And a lot of companies use them as part of the interviewing process.
Right, and it is attempt at getting just cheap sense of control. It's like, I want to apply this cheap and easy algorithm or system that'll give me some sense that I have some control or knowledge over the situation. That's the appeal of it. But of course, it just gives you the illusion of control, which actually takes away your control because you're surrendering it to this pseudoscience and you're maybe allowing it to influence you rather than a more detailed or complete analysis of the person, a more rational analysis. So it's ironic, you know, that the attempt to grab a sense of control actually causes you to surrender a little bit of it.
I hate when that happens.
That's such a type A thing to say, Bob.
Yeah.
I'm O negative. I'm the universal donor, and I can only take O negative blood.
You're a very giving person.
Well, how about that rock band ABBA, you know, ABBA? I mean, they're obviously following
that. Was that their blood types, collective blood types?
Can't prove it, is it?
All those Swedes.
Well, let's go on to your email. The first email comes from Jason Smith in Bangkok, Thailand. And Jason writes, "Hi guys, I've been concerned about a clever argument about how science makes valid testable predictions, whereas non-science merely post-dicts from time to time. Consider the assertion that recent scientific discoveries are conveniently post-dicting old theories which are preferred by the scientific establishment. For example, to be accepted, string theory must predict, in quotes, ordinary quantum mechanics and the standard model. However, Michio Kaku stated in your show that string theory has infinite solutions. Kaku can't lose. He can post-dict whichever solution he needs. Or, so-called transitional fossils, once discovered, are conveniently placed wherever in the tree of life they are needed to support the theory of evolution. Of course, in practice, some discoveries are made chronologically after all the evidence they predict has been collected. To accuse these scientists of foul play may sound quite reasonable, although it is an argument from final consequences, but the distinction can be quite subtle. I do not think this topic warrants a dedicated discussion, but the next time the panel discusses a discovery which predicts already observed evidence, perhaps it is worth identifying this distinction."
There were an astonishing number of dirty words hidden inside that email.
You think
so? I don't know if you noticed. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say them because...
You're just retrofitting. But I do think this is worth a dedicated discussion because this comes up quite a bit, and this is a really important insight into the difference between science and pseudoscience. Science really does require the ability to make predictions about information that does not already exist. That doesn't mean, however, that that's all that science does. You know, in trying to understand nature and to create theories which describe nature in a reliable and accurate way, you know, the ability to predict future information is just one attribute. It also does have to be consistent with existing knowledge. In some of these examples, like with string theory being compatible with what we already know from quantum mechanics and the standard model of particle physics, that's just not about prediction. That statement's a non sequitur. It has to be compatible with it in that if string theory requires that the standard model be something other than what we know it to be, well, then it has to be wrong. That it's just confusing two different criteria of what makes a scientific theory legitimate.
I would think if it predicted everything we know, then it would surely raise my confidence for any predictions of stuff that we don't know yet.
Right, but you still need that last bit, that if this theory is true, it also would predict something we do not yet know. And then if that prediction comes true, then that goes much farther in confirming a theory than just being compatible with existing evidence. The reason for that is that humans are very good at pattern recognition. We're very good at retrofitting ideas to existing facts. I remember I had a discussion with an astrologist once, and they were very impressed with their ability to explain why some, you know, there was a case of a girl who killed herself, and this is a case that was, you know, in the newspapers and it was known in that area. And he did in retrospect, did an astrological chart and was able to explain why she did what she did based upon her astrological chart. Well, of course, he was just retrofitting what he already knew happened and interpreting, you know, her astrological reading in order to fit what had been established already. What astrology doesn't do, however, is predict what's going to happen in the future. Now, he brings up evolution as an example, and evolution is actually an excellent example because evolutionary theory made tons of predictions. It predicted that there would be a mode of inheritance that would allow for the perpetuation of inherited characteristics without infinite dilution, right? This was before genetics was discovered, and evolution required something like genes to exist. A gene does not get infinitely diluted in the population. It actually can propagate through the population undiluted, right? A single gene can be copied without change from parent to child and can spread throughout the population. So that was actually a prediction of evolution. Evolution required that, and it was later discovered. In terms of fossils, yeah, we're trying to piece these things together, but there's lots of fossils that fit into what evolution predicts must exist, at least in the broad brushstrokes. We knew that birds exist, that birds are most, you know, morphologically related to reptiles. Therefore, evolutionary theory predicts that we're going to find fossil evidence of some animals that are somewhere in between birds and reptiles. That was a prediction of evolution. Evolution requires that we would find such fossils, and then we did. We found Archaeopteryx and then a whole host of feathered dinosaurs. That was a confirmation of a prediction made by evolutionary theory.
Yeah, Steve, you were saying how that there, you know, the fossils, the transitional fossils, were conveniently placed wherever in the tree of life they are needed to support the theory of evolution. But, I mean, going along with what you're saying, it's not where it was needed. Like, oh, here's a hole, let's throw it in here. But it's where it was predicted to fit. So it's a little, it's right, a little more than just like, oh, here's a hole, let's put it in here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's more like here's a puzzle piece hole that perfectly fits this puzzle piece I just found.
That's right. Although, and this is where I think that the creationists exploit a misunderstanding here, is that evolution predicts the broad brushstrokes. Like I said, it predicts that there would be something between reptiles and birds to connect these major groups. But it doesn't predict the fine detail. It doesn't predict exactly what species evolved when into which other species. So we didn't know, for example, evolution doesn't require that birds evolved from dinosaurs. They could have evolved from some other reptile. So when we find fossils, not only are we fitting the puzzle pieces into a hole, but remember, we don't know what the picture is ahead of time. We're also figuring out what the picture is as we go along, and therefore that changes how we think about where the holes are and where the puzzle pieces should go, if that makes sense. So
you extended that metaphor beautifully.
Yeah, it's easy to exploit confusion about the broad brushstrokes of what evolution predicts and requires versus the fine details about what evolved into what when, which we can only retrofit after we find the fossil. And then, you know, it's basically, again, like getting a new puzzle piece with a little bit of the picture together, and that changes how we think about how to draw the tree of evolutionary life. Well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Professor Massimo Piliucci. Massimo, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Massimo is a professor of ecology and evolution at the Stony Brook University. He is the author of several books, including 2006, Making Sense of Evolution, in 2002, Denying Evolution, Creationism, Scientism, and the Nature of Science. He is also the author of a column for the Skeptical Inquirer. And I know recently you started a blog called Rationally Speaking, or not so recently. But of course, the most important thing to say is that you were the very first person to be interviewed on the now famous Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Is that right? Wow.
That's right.
I should mention that on my CV.
And it's only taken us 4 years to have you back.
That's right.
I see you've been busy since we interviewed you last time. Of course, you have a new book out. And you're also working on another book as well?
Yeah, this one should be out by the end of the year or early 2010. It is called, the provisional title is Nonsense on Stilts, How to Tell Science from Bunk. And it's for the general public. It's going to be published by University of Chicago Press. The idea of the book is to explore the difference between science, non-science, and pseudoscience, what philosophers often refer to as the demarcation problem. Mm-hmm. You know, where does science start and non-science or pseudoscience begin? And in doing so, however, it's not just a discussion of the usual suspects such as creationism, intelligent design, astrology, parapsychology, ufology, and all the other ologies that one can think of. But it also wanders into territory that it's a little bit more complicated and probably more relevant to people's lives, such as how science is presented or misrepresented in the media, what is the role of science in politics, and even in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. So it's been a lot of fun to write, and we're now in the final editing stages, and it should be coming out later this year.
Great. And also, you talk about the demarcation problem between science and pseudoscience, and sure, as skeptics, we deal with a lot of this stuff way over to one end of that spectrum, but there's a lot of things that are kind of in the middle that are not really easy to say on what side of the fence they fall on. So are there any topics in particular you covered in the book where you said, gee, this is kind of, you know, not really pure science or pseudoscience, it's somewhat right in the middle there?
That's right. You know, in the so-called the demarcation problem, when one phrases it that way, the image that comes to mind is that of a line sort of sharply dividing science from non-science. But as you said, that's not actually the case. There is a lot of gray areas in there, and the gray areas are actually interesting because those are fields of inquiry that may stay there in sort of limbo forever, you know, epistemological limbo forever, or may become actually mainstream science, or they may turn definitely into the pseudoscience. And the central part of the book deals exactly with those areas, some examples of those areas. And some of the things that I put there may surprise your listeners. For instance, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, the SETI program. I'm a fan of the SETI program. I have I downloaded their screensaver that works. And
SETI
does,
at home,
That's right, SETI at home that does data analysis for them. So it's fun and it's interesting. And, of course, I wish them all the best luck in finding something out there. But on the other hand, if one analyzes the SETI research program as science, it's a little bit wanting. You know, there's no theoretical structure, or the only theoretical structure I could find there was the famous Drake equation that goes back to the late 50s or early 60s, and which really doesn't tell us much in the way of, you know, how do we look for extraterrestrial intelligence. It makes a lot of assumptions that are questionable, such as that extraterrestrial intelligent beings are somehow interested in communicating, which is, you know, a simple projection of human psychology. And it may sound natural to somebody who is a Star Trek fan, like I am, but it's not necessarily indicative of a good scientific guess about what an extraterrestrial intelligence could be. So I consider SETI sort of a borderline. Obviously, should they succeed, which may happen, you know, tomorrow, then that would change dramatically the way in which we see ourselves in the universe, and it would definitely put them squarely into the realm of science. But there is a very good chance that they will never succeed, and there is also a very good argument that can be made that their hypothesis simply cannot really be tested in the long run.
Yeah, that is a great example, because that is one that I often hear skeptics arguing about. So among scientists and skeptics, we can have disagreements about whether or not SETI qualifies as quote-unquote real science. Although, and I tend to be on the side that thinks that it is, although you just have to take it for what it is. You can't impose upon it criteria that are not appropriate to what it is trying to do. For example, you said if it succeeds tomorrow, well, the very fact that it can succeed, doesn't that make it legitimate? I mean, doesn't that offer it legitimacy? It's doing something where there can be an objective outcome.
Well, yes and no. So let me play devil's advocate. As I said, I am also very sympathetic to the SETI search in general. But one can make the same argument about, you know, or could have made, I suppose, thousands of years ago, the same argument about astrology. Well, you know, it could have succeeded. There was no logical reason a priori why astrology had to be bunk. It just happened to be that way. Mm-hmm. It just turned out that it was that way. So in that sense, then astrology is, one can consider it is in fact a scientific endeavor. It's just that it's a failed scientific endeavor. Well, some people, some philosophers of science might actually make that argument. Mm-hmm. But I'd be very uncomfortable actually in considering astrology a science at any stage of its development. But the very fact that we're having this discussion is in fact the point that I'm trying to make in the book, which is there is very reasonable disagreement mm-hmm. among intelligent people and knowledgeable people about the status of certain fields of inquiry. And that tells you that demarcation is not a sharp one.
This is a debate that a neurologist and an evolutionary biologist are not going to settle tonight.
Probably shouldn't have.
Right.
But let me give you one example, on the other hand, that is a debate that we might have that it's also covered in my book, and that is evolutionary psychology. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm an evolutionary biologist, and so I have absolutely no problem, obviously, with Darwin's theory and with the application of Darwin's theory, including to humans. And I have no problem with the basic assumption of evolutionary psychology, which is that, in principle at least, it's possible that some human cognitive abilities evolved by natural selection in the recent, not too recent past of human evolution. All of this is perfectly fine. The problem that I point out in the book with evolutionary psychology comes when one starts making specific claims about specific human behaviors and how they evolved by natural selection. And the reason there is a problem there is not because there is something unsound about the general idea, but because human beings happen to be, especially in terms of human behavior, they happen to be a horrible system where to test hypotheses about evolutionary history. So it turns out that, by and large, there are three ways in which evolutionary biologists can possibly test hypotheses about natural selection. One is if you measure natural selection happening right now, which you can do in most organisms, but you can't do it in human beings, or at least you can do it in human beings in their current environment, but that's irrelevant to the claims of evolutionary psychologists, because they say that most human behaviors evolved actually, you know, around the Pleistocene. Mm-hmm. So in a situation where the environment, social and physical, was very different.
Are there any sufficiently isolated hunter-gatherer tribes still in existence that we can use as a reasonable model of Pleistocene man?
That is hard to say because we don't really have much of information about how Pleistocene man actually lived. But yes, it is certainly possible to do that. It's still very difficult to actually measure natural selection on human beings for the simple reason that we have a long lifespan, and especially in small populations, the numbers are simply going to be very small.
Yeah.
So it's either not possible at all if we're talking about Pleistocene, or very, very difficult to do. So that's one possibility, and it's either entirely out or almost. The second way in which evolutionary biologists test hypotheses about the evolution of some traits or others is, of course, through the fossil record. Now, the human fossil record is getting better and better, but of course, unfortunately, most human behaviors don't leave any fossil trace, certainly not the kind of human behaviors that evolutionary psychologists are interested in, so that's out as well. And then the third big one is by doing what is called comparative phylogenetic analysis. That is, you pick a group of close-related species, and if you have enough of them, and if they show enough variation in the characters and the traits that you're interested in, you may be able to tell with a certain amount of rigor which way the direction of evolution went. Mm-hmm. The problem with human beings, of course, as we know, is that we don't have any close relatives. We only have three or four species of primates, you know, two are chimpanzees, one or two are gorillas. They're really not that close related to us. They diverged too far back into our evolutionary ancestry for really them being useful. And at any rate, there is only three or four of them, which simply does not constitute a good statistical sample. Mm-hmm. Had more pre-human or proto-human species survived to modern times, the situation would be different. So what I'm saying is it's not the evolutionary psychologist's fault that we are in that situation. But unfortunately, that's the way it is. And so I take most of what evolutionary psychology says, not really as science per se, but as reasonable narratives about how things might have gone. So that's a much lower standard than a classic science. I don't think it qualifies as classic science, but it is interesting, and they may be even right on some of the things that they're saying.
Right. Yeah, I basically agree. I think that, although, like I was saying with SETI and also with theoretical physics, that there are some endeavors that have some subset of science and that are important and even necessary components of science, but they don't have the whole package. So they're not closing the loop on having a falsifiable, testable hypothesis. And as you say, it may just be for practical reasons. Just, behaviors don't fossilize and we have very few examples. So it's just very, very difficult. Although I'm not giving up on evolutionary psychology, I think that although difficult, somebody may be clever enough to figure out a way to test it in a meaningful way. You wrote recently on your blog, Rationally Speaking, about strong inference and how that is a legitimate scientific endeavor. So is it possible that that kind of a strong inference can apply to evolutionary psychology in a clever way at some point where we might be able to test some of those ideas?
No, I think evolutionary psychology, if it's going to be rescued, it's going to be rescued by other means, but not by strong inference. And so let's summarize briefly what strong inference is. The term was, I'm not sure whether it was introduced by Platt in 1964, but it's not much older than that. And it refers to a particular way of doing science. Think about it this way. If you can ask very clear-cut questions that emit only either a yes or no or no answer, or there is only a very small number of possible answers you can come up with that are admittable. And if you can imagine doing experiments that one by one eliminate all the answers but one, then you're doing strong inference. I claim actually in that blog entry that you've seen, which incidentally is in fact an excerpt from the book, I claim in there that a lot of scientists cannot actually do that, especially organismal biology, especially ecology, evolutionary biology, and of course even more so the social sciences, cannot do that, but it cannot apply strong inference, not because, people are lazy or stupid or they don't know what they're doing. Is because of the way of the subject matter that you're interested in. A lot of questions in ecology, evolutionary biology, psychology, sociology do not admit of simple yes or no answers or of answers that fall into a small number of discrete categories. Very often the answers are quantitative. They're highly dependent on the context, and that's just the nature of the beast. So my point there is that actually just because evolutionary psychology doesn't fit the criterion of strong inference, that actually is not a good argument to dismiss evolutionary psychology. Because if we were that strict, then pretty much only physics and chemistry would be left standing at the end of the day.
So there are weaker forms of inference or just different methods that are used for the social sciences?
Yes. So the major alternative form of inference, it's called sometimes consilience. And now you may remember that there was a famous book by E.O. Wilson with that title that came out back in 1998. Mm-hmm. But he was talking about, actually, he was using the term in a loose way and not exactly in terms of inference. But in philosophy, a consilience is essentially the situation where several lines of inquiry tend to point to the same conclusion, so that although none of the lines of inquiry is definitive, the fact that a lot of them point in the same sort of direction, philosophers sometimes refer to this as a triangulation in logical space. Imagine all these lines of inquiry, and they tend to point toward the same culprit, so to speak. Then you're justified in at least provisionally and probabilistically conclude that that is in fact the right answer. This is, in fact, the way in which, famously, Darwin proceeded. He was very conscious that's what he was doing, that consilience, which is a type of induction, was what he was doing. He dedicated The Origin of Species to Wivel, who was one of the most famous philosophers of the time, and the guy who actually came up with the term consilience. So it's an interesting example historically of a scientist who was very much aware of what he was doing from an epistemological perspective.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, this is the episode that will be out during Darwin Day, February 12th, which is Darwin's 200th birthday and the 150th anniversary of the publication of Origin of the Species. So I do want to, you know, I think, spend the rest of our interview talking about that. There's so much I want to talk to you about, but let's focus a little bit on Darwin and evolution and, of course, creationism. Now, as you say, the consilience is a huge part of a lot of sciences, certainly in medicine, for example, my own field. A lot of our conclusions are based upon this kind of consilience or multiple lines of evidence, but each one of which can be picked apart if you really want, if you're dedicated to denying the conclusion and you go out of your way to miss the big picture. And that's what I see creationists doing. They sort of pick on one little thread at a time and are deliberately not seeing the big picture. So first of all, do you agree that for evolution, that's how we know it is true, although there are some lines of evidence that are pretty damn strong, but it is an established fact because there are so many different lines of evidence that establish it.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, when people say that evolution is both a fact and a theory, what they mean is that the fact of evolution is, you know, evident from evidence such as the fossil record. But of course, the fossil record itself is not seeing evolution happening. It's inferring that evolution happened by the fact that you see a series of changes. You've heard a creationist counter argument that, that really didn't happen. It's just God put things in that way to test your faith.
Right.
Well, there is no logical contradiction in that. It could be that God, in fact, is that malicious, mm-hmm. and that he gives us, you know, misleading information so that many of us can go to hell just for using our brain in the way it's supposed to be used. It's certainly possible. It doesn't contradict any laws of logic, but boy, it's a bad bet.
Right.
Because it denies a lot of convergent evidence toward the conclusion that evolution actually did happen the way in which it looks like in the fossil record. So yes, evolution as a fact is in fact the result of a consilience of evidence, and therefore it is deniable in principle. Pretty much almost everything in science actually is deniable in principle, because you can always come up with alternative scenarios that are more and more convoluted and that account for the same facts. But the question there becomes, at that point, there's a different mechanism that comes in, and that is that usually you evaluate one hypothesis against one or more alternatives. So now the question is no longer, well, is the Darwinian view of evolution correct or not, but rather, you know, is the Darwinian view of evolution better, and in fact, perhaps significantly better, much better, than any alternative view of evolution? Mm-hmm. And it turns out that historically there have been alternative views of evolution that were non-Darwinian. I'm not talking about creationism, which I don't consider science, so I don't think creationism was ever in the ballpark there in competition with Darwinian evolution.
Right.
But for instance, the basic idea of natural selection, which of course was the major idea proposed by Darwin, was very much in doubt by the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. There were alternative theories. There was a resurgence of Lamarckism, of inheritance of acquired characteristics. It was called neo-Lamarckism. There were biologists, you know, professional biologists, serious scientists, who mostly paleontologists, who defended an idea called orthogenesis basically claimed that evolution happens because it's an internal drive that organisms have, and it has nothing to do with natural selection, or natural selection is a minor mechanism. Then people at the beginning of the 20th century rediscovered Mendel's laws, and genetics was born. And the very first thing that people started thinking was, wait, this is a problem for Darwin, because Darwin was talking about continuous variation of small gradual changes in evolution. And the first data that came out of genetics were of traits that were inherited discretely. The Mendelian traits are yes or no. They're, you know, you have either the green peas or the yellow peas. So it looked like genetics was posing a challenge to Darwinism, because it was denying the possibility of having inheritance of continuous characters. It took about 30 years from the 1918 to the end of the 1940s to actually figure out why the new genetics did not in fact pose a problem to Darwin, but through the theory of population genetics, people were actually able to reconcile the two beautifully and to come up with what today we call the modern synthesis, which is essentially the standard modern evolutionary biology. Mm-hmm. So my point is that there were alternatives at several different times during the history of biology. There were serious alternatives that were considered in alternative to the Darwinian theory. So it's simply not the case that Darwinism has been an orthodoxy from the beginning and has never been challenged and so on and so forth. It's just that when the challenges happened, eventually in the long run, Darwinism did win. And it is currently the only theory standing.
In your opinion, what is the biggest deficit in science education that we're facing and that's, you know, in part contributing to things like creationism?
There are actually studies funded that are coming out in the last few years that address that on a systematic basis, that question on a systematic basis. But I can tell you from my own anecdotal experience, which essentially confirms these broader studies. So I typically teach two undergraduate courses here at Stony Brook. And one of them is a course on basically the nature of science. It's a small class. It's based mostly on discussions with the students. And the whole idea of the class is to explore different aspects of how people do science and where science fails and what it fails, why does it fail, and how does it work when it works. Then I switch, literally, usually in the same day, about 20 minutes later, I switch classroom and I go into a large classroom with 500 plus people where I teach an introductory biology class. The introductory biology class is based on a much thicker book. It's about 1,000 pages. It's almost entirely facts. There is no conceptual presentation whatsoever. It's, you know, it's just as much fun as reading the yellow pages from A to Z. Now, in your opinion, which of one of my students are more excited about science at the end of the semester?
Of course, the small theoretical class.
Right, the theoretical and as well as the small class.
Yeah.
Because they enjoy the discussion. So I mean that is the problem, it's part of the problem. The creationism doesn't reduce only to a matter of science education, of course. It's a
right.
complex cultural and historical phenomenon. But as far as science education is concerned, the main problem that we have is that we teach science too much, especially at the pre-college level, but even at the college level, until you get to advanced courses. We teach too much science in terms of just presentation of information, because there is so much information, in fact, that is, it's a field that has been exploding mm-hmm. in the last several decades. And we do not allow the students to think about the nature of what they're doing, the nature of biological discovery. How do we know things about biological organisms? How do we discover these things? How does the science work? We don't teach much in the way of critical thinking. I know that critical thinking has become a buzzword that is now used even, it appears even in high school level texts. But one thing is to use the buzzword. Another thing is to actually teach critical thinking. It's not actually a simple thing at all because it requires quite a bit of background knowledge on the part of the teacher, which most teachers don't have. They're not trained to do that sort of thing. And it also requires small classrooms and one-on-one attention by the teacher, which is something that more and more we cannot afford, either at the pre-college level or the college level, until you get to advanced classes. Mm-hmm. When the students get the benefits of these approaches when they get to advanced classes. But by the time you get to advanced classes in biology in college, you lost most of your audience.
Right.
Very few people get to that point. Other people lose interest in science much earlier on and simply do not pursue it.
That's interesting because there are studies which show that belief in the paranormal, for example, actually increases with overall education. Until you get to advanced science classes, then it decreases.
That's right.
That goes along with what you're saying.
Earlier, right at the beginning of the interview, we were talking about how SETI is considered to be on the fringe. Going with that logic, would you say that anything that current science can't prove would be considered on the fringe until the science progresses enough where we could prove or disprove it?
Yeah, let me put it this way. I think that if one has to give a definition of science, which of course is it's always dangerous because precise definitions of complex concepts are very difficult, if not impossible to give. But if one were to give a definition, I would say that science at the bottom is an activity, is a quest about understanding the natural world, which is based on empirical information and statements about that world in the form of hypotheses, theories, or what you want, that are empirically testable. So the empirical testability of scientific statements is what makes them scientific. So if there is, in fact, no way to seriously or reasonably or test empirically a particular statement, then in my opinion, that makes that statement either non-scientific or, you know, borderline in the case of situations like SETI or string theory, because there may be a way to do it, but we don't actually know how to go about it. We don't have, or we don't have much of a chance to actually be able to do it.
As opposed to, say, intelligent design, which by its very formulation is impossible to disprove.
That's right. There is no set of facts, no set of data or observation that can possibly contradict the intelligent design assumption, because, you know, by definition, we don't know who the intelligent designer is, although wink, wink, of course, creationists will tell you that they do know, but, you know, they know better than actually to make predictions about who the designer is, what he's doing, and how is he doing it. So the major difference, I mean, in that case, SETI is an interesting example, because there is a huge difference between SETI, of course, and intelligent design, although apparently, you know, superficially, they may seem actually similar. But the major difference is that SETI researchers actually do make specific hypotheses about who the designers are and what they're doing and how they're going to go about doing it. They're making, you know, they're projecting essentially human psychology and technology, and they're making predictions. Now, whether those predictions are going to turn out to be true or not, it remains to be seen, but they are sticking their neck out. Intelligent design proponents, on the other hand, don't do that, because they don't tell you who the designer is and what he's up to and how he's going to do it. And unless they tell us that, there is no way to test any hypothesis, because any data whatsoever, any situation that we might encounter out there in the world is perfectly compatible with whatever the anonymous and unknown designer wanted to do for whatever unknown reasons.
Well, thank you, Massimo. This has been a great interview.
It was a pleasure.
And we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week, and the theme is evolution. So three evolutionary items. Ready?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Item number one, paleontologists have published a description of a new transitional whale ancestor 82.5 million years old, suggesting that whales branched off from terrestrial mammals prior to the extinction of dinosaurs 65 million years ago. Item number two, researchers have found evidence of multicellular animal life 100 million years older than the Cambrian explosion. And item number three, paleontologists have discovered fossil evidence of the largest known snake named Titanoboa, which would have weighed 2,500 pounds and spanned greater than 42 feet in length.
Oh, that's the worst name I've ever heard.
Titanoboa.
Gargantu Slither.
That is a pretty terrible name.
Steve, I'm going to say right now, if you did not make up the word Titanoboa, I'm going to be very disappointed at the end of this segment.
Does that mean you're guessing first, Jay?
Do you want to go first, Jay, then?
I'm going first.
Go.
Whoa. All right. Step aside.
Titanoboa is the fake.
Just based purely on the name.
Yep, that's it.
Okay. All right, Rebecca.
Oh, my gosh.
Seriously, just because of the name, Titanoboa.
That's it.
Wow.
All right. I think Titanoboa is a fact, and I look forward to seeing Anaconda 3, Titanoboa.
Starring Titanoboa.
So that leaves us with a transitional whale ancestor, 82.5 million years old, which seems pretty old. I can buy the whale fossil thing, but I'm not so sure about the age. So let's see. And then the other thing is, yeah, multicellular animal life, 100 million years older than the Cambrian explosion. Again, I have serious timeline issues here. So frankly, I'm not really sure which to go with. But I'm going to lean towards the multicellular animal life, that 100 million years older than the Cambrian explosion. That, what are you whispering, Evan? Are you whispering that Titanoboa to try to throw me? I think that...
Titanoboa.
No, you know, I was going to go with the multicellular animal life one, but now I'm going to flip it. I'm going to go with the whale.
Oh, why don't you pick the one with me? Come on.
Because that's the only one I'm positive is true. Because Titanoboa is obviously an awesome name. The other two I'm not so sure about.
Okay, Bob.
Titanoboa, yeah. I mean, what else would you call a really, really, really big snake? 42 feet in length and 2,500 pounds. That's not crazy. I mean, it's not like it's a 200-foot snake. 42, I mean, sounds reasonable. I think if Steve was going to lie about that, he would have exaggerated that a little bit more. The multicellular life, 100 million years older than the Cambrian explosion. Yeah, that's a long time before the Cambrian explosion. I'm not so sure about that one. But number one, the whale splitting off 82.5 million years off of terrestrial mammals. That's not sitting right with me. Something about that. I mean, mammals were pretty tiny back then. I'm gonna go with that one. The whale one is fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Okay, so I'll take them in reverse. Titanoboa. I think that one is science. I think it's too cool not to be science, and it could see Godzilla versus Titanoboa. So that's very cool. All right, so that one's science, and then I was gonna say, you know, this Cambrian explosion and the 100 million years older than that. I mean, that is so far, even a relative sense, I think it's very far, prior to this mass explosion of simple life on the planet, that to go back 100 million years prior to that and find multicellular animal life. Yeah, so I think the only thing that is sitting less right with me is the whale. I don't see it. I always thought that there were no large mammals that survived prior to 65 million years ago. I think little rats and stuff were pretty much the largest things, I think, to remain. So I'm going to have to say that the whales, that one is fiction.
Well, let's take these in reverse order.
Okay.
Like Evan did. We'll start with paleontologists have discovered fossil evidence of the largest known snake named Titanoboa, which would have weighed 2,500 pounds and spanned greater than 42 feet in length, and that one is science.
Okay.
Jay, you did fall for my trap. I did make a point to include the name Titanoboa just to see if it would strike somebody as silly and get them
sure
to say
did.
It for that reason.
Yeah, I figured it was me.
But Titanoboa is a perfectly cromulent name. I mean, there are Titanotheres and other Titano animals. I mean, that
That's
prefix
right.
is commonly used for large species. And, you know, I didn't think it was going to be that far out because, it's only a little bit bigger than, say, the boa living today. So this is this creature, the Titanoboa serogenensis, was discovered 60 million year old South American snake. It is about 42.7 feet in length, which is about 13 meters. Now, the current biggest or longest, I should say, species of snake today is the reticulated python of Southeast Asia, which is 10 meters. So, you know, it's bigger, 13 meters versus 10 meters, but it's not twice as big or, you know, that much bigger.
2,500 pounds.
So that's plausible. It also occurs at a time when there were many very large species. So there actually was an age of gigantism, you know, back
greater
then.
Greater oxygen, yeah.
Probably because there was greater oxygen in the atmosphere and just was physiologically able to maintain larger species. So it's not a surprise that there were big everything back then. There were giant baboons, there were giant insects, there were giant everything. So no biggie there. It also may have to do with the fact that it was warmer back then and higher temperatures would allow for larger cold-blooded species.
The problem, though, is that when in a few years when they find one even bigger, what are they, you know, how do you get bigger than Titan? Ginormous boa or Bob Dignagian boa, something like that.
Super mega boa. So let's go to number two. Researchers have found evidence of multicellular animal life 100 million years older than the Cambrian explosion.
That's old.
That's old.
That's old, folks.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm. And that one is also science.
Wow.
Nine years. Cool.
That's
really
incredible.
Cool.
This is awesome.
Yeah,
cool.
100 million years. Woof.
Yeah. Now, so that's certainly a little surprising from one perspective, but not surprising from another perspective. So the Cambrian explosion is when we first find fossil evidence of multicellular life, you know, in the fossil record. And this, the date for this has been pushed back slowly over the years. Now it's around 580 million years ago. But it was always believed that that was when animals developed the first hard bits that fossilize. But there had to be some pre-existing multicellular life that just didn't have hard bits that fossilize yet. They had to evolve through some period. But it wasn't known, of course, how long that period would be. Was it 10 million years, you know, 50 million years? It's not clear. And this evidence is not fossils, right? So this it still is not – we still there, these are not fossils from before the Cambrian explosion. This is just evidence that there was animal life before the Cambrian explosion. What scientists found was a modified form of cholesterol produced by sponges. And it's that's the only known way for this chemical to exist.
Good cholesterol or bad cholesterol?
Yeah, right. Sponge cholesterol. This suggests that these creatures existed around 630 million years ago or earlier.
So are you saying that we basically know this because SpongeBob had too many Krabby Patties back then?
That's right.
Just checking.
That's
right.
I knew there was science somewhere in that show.
This is you know, very, very interesting. It also takes a lot of the wind out of the sails of the creationists who like to exploit, again, misunderstanding about the Cambrian explosion. They say, oh, scientists say life suddenly appears in the fossil record. Well, what could cause something to suddenly appear? Creation, perhaps? But it's such simple-minded nonsense. Of course, suddenly appear means over 5 to 10 million years. That's a long time. And again, that's only once things started to fossilize. We knew there was a pre-existing period where they were evolving complexity leading up to the threshold of fossilization. And now there's evidence for it going back even further.
Mm-hmm. And therefore...
Paleontologists have published a description of a new transitional whale ancestor 82.5 million years old, suggesting that whales branched off from terrestrial mammals prior to the extinction of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago is complete and utter fiction.
Woohoo.
Okay.
Yeah, that is a little early. Now, I mean, there were more than tiny. There were larger mammals. You know, there were, at that time, dog size or even a little bit larger. They weren't all just, you know, rat size. That's a bit of a myth. The terrestrial ancestors of whales were about that size. They were not huge. You know, the whales didn't become huge until after they took to the water. So that one isn't quite far-fetched as it may seem. However, it is not true. What is true is that a new species of whale ancestor was recently described, although this one dates to 47.5 million years ago. The first whale ancestor dates back to about 52 million years ago, so after the dinosaurs went extinct. And they did evolve from a group of mammals, of terrestrial mammals. They evolved from wolf-sized carnivores named creodonts, and the first whales are called Archaeocetus, ancient whales. What that means.
Okay.
The first of these are all coming out of Pakistan in that area. The first whale ancestor was called Pachycetus after Pakistan. A slightly more recent whale is Ambulocetus, yeah, the walking whale. And essentially, over the last 20 or so years, we've discovered different whale ancestors showing a gradual adaptation from land to sea. Again, this is a slam dunk, home run, touchdown, every sports metaphor you could think of, win for evolution. We knew that these animals had to exist. They had to exist roughly in this time frame. And we found them. And we found them showing the nose moving back from the front to the top of the forehead, the legs and arms shrinking, the tail fluke expanding, the size growing. I mean, it doesn't get better. It's such a beautiful evolutionary sequence. And now we have one more. Now we have another whale ancestor. This one described by Philip Gingrich, who was actually the guy who found the first one, Pachycetus. And this one is called Myocetus inuus. And this is cool. So in this fossil bed in Pakistan, they found...
Gave birth on land? Is this one that gave birth on land?
Yes, exactly, with a fetus inside of it. And at a later time, but in the same fossil bed, they found the male of the same species. So now we have a mommy, a daddy, and an unborn fetus. And the fetus was head out. Land mammals tend to give birth head first, whereas whales give birth tail first. So they think this may mean that this whale ancestor was still giving birth on land, had not yet adapted to giving birth in the ocean. It had legs that it used to swim, so it had flippers, but could still probably walk clumsily on land. You could think of something like a seal, that is adapted to swimming, but still has limbs and can flop around on land if it has to. It was returning to land to breed and to give birth probably, but was then taking to the sea for food, for hunting.
Well, I'd love to see that.
So all cool evolution-related news items this week.
You're
very
right.
Happy about it.
Steve, there was a theme.
There was a theme, and this is all to celebrate, of course, Darwin Day.
That was a good theme.
Yeah.
All right, Darwin.
Thank you, Steve.
Next week will be Lincoln. Oh, wait.
I'll have to do Lincoln-related news items.
We'll talk about that next week.
I could think about that, or maybe expand it to early Americans or something. I don't know. Well, Evan.
Oh, yeah.
We are all
Who's that
breathlessly
noisy?
Waiting Who's to hear that? The results of last week's Who's That Noisy?
For those of you who missed it, for both of you who missed it, here was last week's Who's That Noisy?
I was interested in theoretical physics, explaining atoms, vibrations.
Okay, so that was Edward Teller.
Edward Teller.
Nuclear physicist, father of the hydrogen bomb.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah. Powerful man.
And quite a magician, though. Doesn't say much.
That's true. Yeah, so, and what I did is I took a clip of him from a rare interview that I found on YouTube of him. And I chopped it up a little so it couldn't exactly be Googled, for those of you who tried to,
yeah.
Do a little Google cheating out there. But we do have a winner, and someone did guess correctly, and that person replied on the boards. They are Skeptember Morn.
Oh, God.
That's what it says. Skeptember Morn.
It's terrible.
Oh, my goodness.
And congratulations to him or her.
Congratulations.
Well done.
You win nothing.
Yeah, you win nothing.
Evan, what do you got for this week?
All right, listen closely.
Listening.
And tell me, who's that noisy? Here it comes.
What?
Did you get that? That is it. That's
baby?
All you get.
That was
you
the whole
want
thing.
To hear it one more time?
Yeah.
Yes.
Here it comes one more time.
That's Elmo.
That's it.
Actually,
that's...
I know exactly what that not. Is.
So... Give it your best shot, folks. Identify that noisy, and I wish you all the best luck.
You are diabolical, Mr. Bernstein. So, Jay, the quote.
Yes, the quote tonight, Marcus Tullius Cicero. I am not ashamed to confess that I am ignorant of what I do not know. Marcus Tullius Cicero.
Marcus Aurelius.
Sent in by Chris Everett.
That's almost by definition, right?
Yeah,
but I guess the point is, if you're ignorant of something, you may not know even that you're ignorant of it.
And he's not ashamed to admit it.
We're not ashamed to admit it.
Cicero was a Roman philosopher, a statesman, a lawyer, a political theorist, and Roman constitutionalist. Man, why do all these historical figures have like dozens of titles? I have another announcement. We launched the website, and it's buggy as hell.
That's a little anticlimactic, Jake, and you like build it up a little bit more, maybe?
After a year.
A year in the making, and we have a year. Gorgeous but buggy website.
We were very excited. We kept putting it off. We were waiting for things and people and everything, but it finally, everything kind of gelled, and Jeremy and I last week just were like, okay, that's it. We're launching it. As is, right now, we're going to launch it. We had to draw a line in the sand and just say, there was still some work left to be done, but we launched it. Of course, it launched with some bugs. It's still buggy. Hopefully, by the time you guys hear this, we'll have fixed most of the bugs. We're listening to feedback on the forum,
And if you want to email us any feedback that you have, I'd appreciate it.
Well, thank you all for joining me again this week.
You too, Steve.
And happy Darwin Day, everyone.
You too, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.